So let me just jump right in. This lesson, we're going to head into looking at the life of Jesus, and we're going to look at racial justice in terms of looking in the Gospels and seeing about in the life of Jesus. I need to slow down a little bit so I won't run out of air. So let me just pause and breathe. Last week, we talked about Genesis 1 and the book of Revelation. We looked at the beginning and the end, and we looked at how God, even in his own nature, is unity with diversity, three in one. We also saw how God created humanity in his image, the imago Dei, and because of that, when we look at each other, we need to see the image of God. Yes, we are different, and there's diversity all around us, but at our hub and at our center is the image of God. That's how God made us, and that's what we need to see in each other. And then we looked at, in Revelation, at the new heaven and the new earth. And when the new heaven comes down to the new earth, it will be made up of all tribes and languages and ethnicities and nations. And so we saw that since that's what heaven is going to be like, the new heaven and the new earth, the kingdom of God should be working toward that right now. And that's what the church should be about. We also did a little dive into methodology where we saw that, okay, racism isn't specifically mentioned in the Bible, but that's okay. There are other concepts that aren't specifically mentioned in the Bible, but the principles.
Oh gosh, I missed it.
It's okay, Shirley. It's good to have you. We talked about dating, for example, that's not mentioned specifically in the Bible, but principles are there. So tonight, we're going to move on to the ministry of Jesus. And our goal is to go this week from being informed to being concerned. If you remember, we talked about the head and the heart and the hands, or the hands and the feet. So we're moving from the head knowledge, being informed, which we began last week, to this week moving towards the heart, which is about empathy and about compassion and about caring and about concern. And next week, we're going to move towards hands and feet and being active in racial justice. So that's our movement from the head to the heart, to the hands and the feet. So tonight we are focusing on compassion and empathy. And there's no better place to go to understand compassion and empathy than the life and ministry of Jesus, because he was the most compassionate person to ever walk the face of the earth. So that's what we're going to do. And if you know me very much at all, you know I constantly go back to Jesus. I mean, I just look at Jesus as our example in life. And so you probably knew it wouldn't take me very long to get to Jesus. And so that's where we are today. I want to begin by quoting Esau Macaulay. He wrote a book. It was actually given the award by Christianity Today as the book of the year last year, called Reading While Black. And he writes this: Jesus's ministry and the kingdom that he embodies involves nothing less than a creation of a new world in which the marginalized are healed spiritually, economically, and psychologically. So Jesus, in his own kingdom, was about creating a new world, a movement in which a new world would be formed, in which people would be made whole, and everyone would have a right to be a part of that movement. So we'll continue to use the methodology we used last week. We do recognize that race and racism is a modern sociological concept, and it's not mentioned specifically in the ministry of Jesus. However, we do find instances in the ministry of Jesus where he talked against ethnic, or you could say racial, bias, prejudice, against retaliating against others who have hurt us. And all of these things apply to racial justice. And so just because the term isn't there specifically or literally doesn't mean that concepts and principles aren't found in the Gospels. Jesus, for example, taught his followers that they ought to love neighbor, love enemies, reconcile their relationships with each other. And of course, Jesus saw the imago Dei in the lives of every person and treated every person with dignity and respect. And he taught that the temple of God there in Jerusalem should be a house of prayer for all nations. We'll get to that toward the end of our study. And so we're going to look at heart and compassion and empathy. And of course, you probably know my favorite Greek word of all is splanknizomai. I did a sermon on that, on compassion, splanknizomai. And that word means compassion. It's translated as compassion. It's actually a passive tense because God gives us compassion. And the word itself, the beginning of it, splank, all those consonants and one vowel, splank means our insides, our guts, our intestines, which is to say that to be compassionate means you're moved inside to do something. And that's what we see in the life of Jesus, and that's what we should see in what we're trying to be and trying to do, to have a heart for people. So I just want to very quickly mention two passages that I would encourage you to go back and explore more. We don't have time to do everything tonight. And so I've preached on this a lot, and you can go back and look at some of my lessons on this. But in Mark 12, verses 28 through 34, Jesus is asked, what is the most important commandment of all the 613 commandments? And I'm sure you know his answer. It's to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, or love God with everything you have. But he doesn't stop there. Instead, he adds, and love your neighbor as yourself. So in looking at that, what you see is that Jesus is saying to his followers, loving God has to also be translated into loving other people. And that's right at the heart of this idea of compassion and empathy. If we love God, then we're going to love other people. And that certainly applies to racial justice. So take a look at that. And the other passage I would ask you to take a look at, because we just don't have time to look at everything tonight, and I want to drill down on the cleansing of the temple tonight. That's what I really want us to look at as a passage. But I hope that you'll have time this week to look at the story of the Good Samaritan. It's found in Luke chapter 10, verses 30 through 37. And this parable of the Good Samaritan, it's where you see this idea of splanknizomai, of compassion. And Jesus there is not just saying really what it means to be a good neighbor, what it's saying, or who is our neighbor. He's not just answering that question. He's actually saying, this is how you need to be neighborly to other people. And the way to be neighborly to other people is to have compassion and to have empathy and to meet the needs of people around us, which definitely applies to racial justice, seeing the needs that are there and meeting needs. And that's the only parable of all the parables that Jesus gave, where at the end of it, he actually looks at his audience and he says, go and do likewise. Of all the parables, it's the only one where Jesus says that. He expects his people to be like the Good Samaritan. And of course, when you see Samaritan versus the Jewish leaders that pass by this person that was beaten on the road, ethnicity comes into play there. Nationality comes into play there. And Jesus is saying that our ethnicity, our nationality, our race should not keep us apart from each other. Instead, we should take care of each other and we should be empathetic and compassionate toward each other. There should be concern. So loving neighbor means that we are neighborly to other people. Okay. Now, compassion and empathy should lead to us moving toward people and helping people. And I want to talk specifically right now about something that comes up when we talk about racial justice, and that is systemic racism. And you might think, well, systemic racism, that's certainly not found in the Bible. And if you're looking at it from a literal sense, then I would say, yes, you're right. It's not, doesn't matter which translation you look at. You're not going to find systemic racism if you do just a word search in any of the translations. It's just not there. However, the idea of systemic evil is, the idea and the principle is there in the Bible. And you can even see it in the ministry of Jesus, and you can even see Jesus take a stand against systemic evil in his own ministry. And that's where I want us to go tonight. So we're going to go into the weeds a little bit here now, okay? And I just want to warn you. So you might want to get on your hiking boots, or you might want to get out the tick spray, because we're going to get into the weeds a little bit as we talk about this. But then we'll get into the Bible, and I'll show you some Bible verses that really will help us, hopefully, to understand this. Jesus not only taught about compassion and empathy, he lived it. He lived it in his life. When he saw people being hurt, when he saw people disinherited, he acted. He did something. He did this in his interpersonal relationships with people. For example, the woman by the well, the Samaritan woman, when social convention said, as a man, you don't talk to her. And social convention said, as a Jew, you don't talk to her. She's a Samaritan. Jesus could care less about that. And he went up to her and he started a conversation with her. And so in his interpersonal relationships with the Syrophoenician woman, same thing. Jesus shows and demonstrates us that compassion and empathy overcome tribalism, nationalism, race, gender. Compassion and empathy overcome those things. And so he acted in an interpersonal way, demonstrating compassion. But another thing that we see is that he acted against systemic evil on an institutional level, not just on a personal level, but on an institutional level as well. And we'll look at this when we look at the cleansing of the temple. So there's a big question that comes up in talking about racial justice. And the question is, does systemic evil even exist? Or does systemic racism even exist? I mean, people really do ask that question. Now, here's the thing. For those of you that are people of color that have undergone the oppression of systemic racism, I'm sure you're thinking, yeah, it exists. I've experienced it so many times in my life. But it's other people, especially like white supremacists, that say, no, it doesn't exist. There's only the personal level of sin, and there's only the personal level of evil, and there's only personal culpability, but there's not systemic evil. And so we need to take a look at that, because honestly, sometimes you run into this. But here's a couple of examples, okay? One example is Nazi Germany. If you were asked to a Jew who survived the Holocaust, if there was systemic evil and systemic racism in Nazi Germany, they would say, well, of course, I experienced it. I don't need to do an academic study on that. Nobody needs to do an academic study on that. Just look at history. But there are other people that would deny it. Or if you asked a Black South African who went through the years of apartheid, then they would say the same thing. Yes, I experienced it. And I think when you apply those examples, it's very easy to see. There was absolute systemic evil in Nazi Germany, and there was systemic racism in Nazi Germany. Well, that is equally applicable to the Jim Crow laws in the United States. It's equally applicable to any type of discrimination that we see around us on an institutional level. And yet some conservative Christians, some evangelical Christians want to say that systemic evil, it's just a red herring to get people from thinking about their own personal sin. And I've heard preachers say that. I go on the internet because I like to look at both sides of an issue. So I listen to conservative people, and then I listen to progressive liberal people. And there are some conservative even after the death of, the murder of George Floyd, there were preachers that got on line and said that kind of thing. Though we need to study this out and to be able to answer people's questions. You know, just yesterday I attended a lecture, an interview, a discussion between Cornel West. If you know Cornel West, he's a Democrat, progressive Democrat, maybe social Democrat. And then he was having a discussion with Robert George. Robert George is a Catholic conservative. And it was a really amazing, and it was hosted by Pepperdine University. I was given an invitation and I attended. And it was really amazing to see these two people that were, in some ways, they're at polar opposites when it comes to their point of view politically, but they discussed their topics with such love and admiration and genuine affection for each other. It was a beautiful thing to see. It's the kind of thing you don't see very often in modern day politics and modern day academic circles even. It just doesn't exist very much. But it was a really great discussion. And it reminded me that in the church, this is how we need to discuss these things. Because some of us might be coming out of a background in which we don't understand systemic racism because we're not people of color and we haven't experienced it. And therefore we wonder, well, does it exist? You ask somebody who is a person of color that has experienced it and they'll say, I don't need to study on that. I don't need to go to school to learn about that. I've seen it all my life. And that's why we need to have conversations. And that's why we need to talk. One of the things I appreciate about Cornel West was, he's very prophetic in the way that he speaks. But one of the things he said, you know, as Christians, we have to demolish all idols. And if you have an idol of a political leader, that you have to demolish that idol. And he didn't just say Trump, he said Clinton as well. You know, that's what he'll do. He'll just talk on both sides of the aisle. And he'll say, whoever that might be, or whatever that might be, talk about greed, the military industrial complex. I mean, it was great what he had to say. And I learned a lot from listening to this dialogue between the two of them. But here's what I want to get across tonight. The idea of personal culpability for sin and the ability of systemic culpability of evil or sin, they don't have to be an either or. They can be a both and. Because as individuals, we do make wrong choices, but also institutions, organizations, governments, and corporations do at times have unjust policies that need to be challenged. And so both are true. Jamar Tisby in his book, How to Fight Racism, says this: individual agency matters significantly. So personal agency matters significantly. Even in a world where institutions wield enormous power, and institutional policies and practices can limit the personal choices and the number of good options that individuals have available to them. So he's saying it's a both and, it's not an either or. And he says racial justice must occur at both the individual and the institutional level. And then he writes this, and I like this statement: others may criticize the practices proposed here as liberal, leftist, socialist, Marxist, communist, or promoting critical race theory. But such accusations are historical. And I think sometimes those labels are just tossed out there as red herrings to get people to not think about that there is systemic institutional evil that's going on. I'll give you a quick example of a both and is a little bit more it doesn't apply to Nazi Germany or to apartheid or to Jim Crow laws. It's the opiate addiction that we have in our country right now. the sale of opioids and the big pharmacy, big pharma, especially Purdue Pharma. You think, well, they can't be guilty because they're not sticking the needle in their arm. They're not making people take these tablets. But it has been proven that they knew how addictive these drugs were. And they did nothing to educate people to their addictive quality. And that was unjust on their part. And so they've been found guilty in the court of law. The New York Times reports Purdue Pharma pleaded guilty on Tuesday to criminal charges. They just ended up pleading guilty as an institution that they misled the federal government about the sale of its blockbuster painkiller, oxycodone, prescription opioid that helped fuel a national addiction crisis. And so that's a both and. Yes, people took the medication themselves, but Big Pharma knew what was going on and they misled the federal government in what was going on. And now the federal government's going after Walmart. They say, well, how in the world can Walmart be guilty of this? Well, this is what the Times reports. The Justice Department sued Walmart on Tuesday for what it said was the company's role in fueling the national opioid crisis by allowing its network of pharmacies to fill millions of prescriptions of opiates, thousands of which authorities said were suspicious. And so they were after the money and they just filled suspicious prescriptions and turned the other eye. That is institutional injustice there. And so we see that in when we look at something like the pharmaceutical industry. We can also see it in other industries as well. So it's a both and, it's not an either or. And what I want you to see tonight is that when it comes to institutional injustice, Jesus, number one, suffered it in his own life. And number two, stood up against it when he had an opportunity to stand up against it. First, the idea that Jesus suffered from it. And you need no better illustration of how Jesus suffered from systemic evil and systemic injustice than just to think about the cross of Christ. The cross is the greatest example in the world of there being systemic evil that oppressed someone who did not deserve to be oppressed. Jesus was righteous. In fact, Jesus only made right decisions. He did not sin. It was not his own sin that sent him to the cross. It was the sin of the world that sent him to the cross. And there are many verses that talk about this. And I'll give you a few. You can look at them and I'll read one. 2 Corinthians 5:21. That's one of them. 2 Corinthians 5:21. Galatians 3, verse 13. That's another one. Galatians 3:13. Titus 2:14. And I'll read 1 Peter 3, verse 18. Christ the Messiah also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, in order that he might lead you to God. He was put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit. He suffered for sin, even though he was righteous, you know, even though he had not sinned himself. So if you were to ask Jesus, do you believe in systemic injustice? He would say, yeah, I actually faced it in my life. I don't need a scientific study. I don't need an academic study. I face systemic evil and systemic injustice. And it was power that put him on the cross, ultimately, because you had the Roman authorities and you had the Jewish authorities, and they're the ones that sent him to the cross. And so he faced injustice from both of those groups, as well as just from the whole world. And so if you ever hear somebody say, well, I don't believe in systemic injustice, I don't believe in systemic evil, I don't believe in systemic racism, then just, you know, think of the cross. Think of the cross, because that's a great example there. Now, I'm going to look at one particular instance in the life of Jesus. I think there are more, there's more than this one, but I want to look at the one that I feel like more than any others points out that Jesus did stand against systemic evil and injustice in his own life. And this is the story of Jesus cleansing the temple. Now, I'm going to need to go into the weeds again a little bit because I want to give you a little background on the Temple of Jerusalem. It's important that whenever you study something in the Bible, that you actually do a little background study to see what was going on. And so when you look at the temple in the Second Temple period, that's what it was called in the first century there. It's actually the Second Temple period. I won't go into all that. But when you look at that, you have to see, okay, what was the temple at that time? And that's important. Because when we look at the cleansing of the temple, this is a very important and central story in the Gospels and in the life of Christ. In fact, it's so important that it's told in all four Gospels, not just in the Synoptic Gospels minus John, that's Matthew, Mark, and Luke, minus John, but even in John. And in fact, in John, he puts it at the beginning of the ministry of Jesus, and the other Gospels put it at the end of the ministry of Jesus. Now, that might matter, it might not, because there's a debate on how important chronology is in Gospel studies. But the fact that it's mentioned in all four Gospels, and the fact that it could have happened twice. Jesus could have cleansed the temple at the beginning of his ministry, like John says, and at the end of his ministry, like Matthew, Mark, and Luke say. That shows us that this cleansing of the temple was central in the ministry of Jesus. It was an incredibly important event. And so let's take a look at it. Repetition is a rhetorical device that was used in the ancient world to help people memorize things and help people learn stories. So the fact that this story is repeated not once, not twice, but four times, that's important. Just like the Passover event was repeated every year for the Jews so that they would not forget. We should not forget this event. Now here's the thing about the temple. Go into the weeds a little bit here. The temple was the most important symbol of Judaism. Not a close second. It was head and shoulders above anything else. King David, anything. This temple was the most important symbol in Judaism. It was also Judaism's most important institution. Okay, it was the single most important institution in Judaism. The religious and political leaders, the Sanhedrin, who led the Jewish people, they met in the temple court at Solomon's colonnade. And I've actually visited that part of the temple area when I was in Jerusalem. And so in that sense, the temple was like the U.S. Capitol building. Now you saw what happened last Wednesday, when people went into the Capitol building and what an uproar that has caused across the country. Imagine Jesus standing up in the temple, their Capitol building, and starting to turn things over, starting to drive out the animals. Imagine the reaction. That is the type of reaction that we saw last week. And Jesus was taking a stand there. Why? That's what we're going to get to. Why? Also, it was the Bank of Israel. That's where the funds to basically support the nation of Israel were kept at the temple. So it was not only their Capitol building where political decisions were made, it was also their national bank. So in a sense, it was their U.S. Federal Reserve, but their Judah Federal Reserve. Also, it was the heart of their religion, the heart of their religious program. It was their most important religious institution, not a close second. The sacrificial system, which was on view daily at the temple, was something that was highly regarded by the Jewish people. In that sense, it's like Roman Catholicism looking at the Vatican today and how the Vatican sort of operates in all these ways for Roman Catholicism, their political center, their bank, and their religious center. And so you got to understand that when Jesus goes into the temple and cleanses it, maybe not once, but maybe twice, definitely recorded in all the Gospels, he is right there at the hub of the political, economic, and religious life of all of Judaism. All of Jewish life revolved around the temple. And beside that, there was the Ark of the Covenant there, which was housed in the Holy of Holies. And scripture taught that the presence of God hovered over the Ark of the Covenant. So the temple was looked at as the house of God. When Jeroboam became king of the northern kingdom, one of the first things he did was set up two different sites for people to do their sacrifices so they wouldn't have to go to Jerusalem, because he knew that everybody in the north and the 10 tribes in the north would be drawn to Jerusalem if he didn't set up an alternate way of worshiping. In the first century, the temple was placed on the list of, and several of the list of, the one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And the temple complex, Josephus said, if you've not seen the temple in Jerusalem, you've not seen a building in all of its glory. When the Babylonians came into Jerusalem, what did they do? They destroyed it. Why? Because it was the heart of their civilization, of Jewish civilization, of Jewish life. Same thing with the Romans. When they finally got fed up with all the rebellions going on in and around Israel, what did they do? They marched into Jerusalem and destroyed the temple, and they made a trash dump out of it. Okay, they started putting their trash on top of the Temple Mount. That just shows you this was an important symbol. Now, let's read the story in Mark, and I'll make a couple of points from this. In Mark 11, verse 15, I hope you're all with me. I know that was a lot. Let's get into the Bible. You guys ready to get into the Bible now? Let's get into the Bible. Let's look at some scriptures, and hopefully we'll come out of the weeds a little bit and see what's going on here. Okay, it says here, Mark says, they came to Jerusalem. When they entered the temple, this is Jesus and his disciples, as he's there in this last week, the week before the cross, called the Passion Week. When they entered the temple, he began to drive out those who were buying and selling in the temple. And so he goes into the temple, he sees this marketplace going on, and he takes a stand. He actually starts driving out those who were buying and selling. And it says he turned over the table of the money changers and the seats of those selling doves. He did not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple. People that were grabbing merchandise, he just stopped it. And this is what he says. He says, he taught them saying, is it not written, my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of robbers. The chief priest and all the experts of religious law heard about this. They didn't have to, they were just a few hundred meters away, so they could hear about it very easily. And they considered how they might destroy him. Why? He'd attack their central institution. For they feared him, because the whole crowd was amazed at his teaching. When evening came, they exited the city. Now you ask, why did Jesus do this? Why would Jesus take this stand against the temple? Well, it's actually right there in the text, and two reasons are given right there in the text. First, Jesus desired, and he says in verse 17, my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations. And it was no longer that. In the temple, a court was built called the Court of the Gentiles. And it was a place where the Gentiles, non-Jews, could come and they could pray. And the part of the temple that the religious leaders had turned into a market, guess where it was located? In the court of the Gentiles. And so now what should have been a place of prayer for the Gentiles was a market. And so he takes a stand there and he says, this temple should be a house of prayer for all nations and all people. But the part that should go to the Gentiles, you have turned it into a marketplace, and he takes a stand about on that. So that's the first thing that you see there. In Isaiah 56, verses 6 and 7, it says, all the foreigners who join themselves to the Lord to minister to him, to love the name of the Lord, and to be his servants, all who keep the Sabbath and do not profane it, and hold fast my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain, Zion, and I will make them joyful in my house of prayer. This is what he's quoting here. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar, for my house shall be a house of prayer for all nations. This is talking about foreigners here. What the religious leaders did is they basically quashed that. And they didn't have to. It was a choice that they made to overrun the court of the Gentiles. This is something I even just learned recently. Just years before this, there was a marketplace where sacrifices would be bought and sold and money would be exchanged, but it wasn't located in the temple. It was actually located on the Mount of Olives, just across from the temple. But in order to make it more efficient and to raise more money, they moved it into the court of the Gentiles, pushing the Gentiles out. And not only that, on the high and holy days, I just learned this recently also, they made the marketplace even bigger so that even fewer Gentiles could be a part of that. So on the Passover, for example, they would make it an even bigger marketplace. And this is just before the Passover. Jesus is looking at the big market here. He takes a stand for people that are disinherited. See that? That's what he's doing there. He's taking a stand for the disinherited. And he's saying, this is not right. This is not how God looks at people. This is not how God envisions the temple. And anybody could have taken a stand. Jesus is the one who did. And he said, this is not right. There's systemic injustice. There's systemic evil. All of you leaders, you know what's going on and you know what you're doing. And you're keeping the Gentiles from worship. I'm going to take a stand on this. Because these people who should be able to come, you're not allowing them to come. They were the disinherited, and Jesus took a stand. So in a sense, if you want to, you can say there was racial injustice going on because the main people that were taking the brunt of this were the Gentiles. It wasn't the Jews who still had the court of the women and the court of the men and the priestly court and the Holy of Holies. All of that was still where the Jews could go. But the people who were Gentiles now had no place to go. So again, you don't see the word racial injustice there, but you can kind of find it there. The second reason Jesus took this stand is it says, they're right there in the same verse, it says, you have made it into a den of robbers. They've turned it into a den of thieves. The selling and the buying of sacrifices, the exchange of a coinage at the temple, it was targeting the poor. Again, it was targeting the disinherited. It was targeting people who didn't have the money to be able to afford these sacrifices. So they made these long journeys. Some of them, for example, when Jesus came from Galilee down to Jerusalem, that was a five-day journey walking to get there. And a lot of these poor people made that journey three times a year. And when they got to the temple, what they should have done is been received with open arms. People should have been helping them. People should have been sacrificing for them. Instead, they turned the temple complex into a den of thieves and extorted the poor and made money off the poor and lined their own pockets. The priests especially were lining their own pockets. Jesus took a stand there because he saw the systemic evil and the systemic injustice that was going on in the temple. This extortion of the poor with the reselling of confiscating sacrifices from them, turning around and reselling them at a higher price, making them exchange their foreign coinage at exorbitant prices for the local coinage. That still happens in many countries around the world today. You see that happening. And so Jesus takes a stand against that type of systemic evil and injustice that's going on against the traveler, the sojourner, and the poor. people that in the Old Testament were protected by God. But these people around the temple had forgotten that. So when Jesus says, and he says this specifically, you have made it a den of thieves. Think about that. Who is the you? Who is the you that he's talking about here? Well, he's talking about a couple of groups. The main group he's talking about are the religious leaders, the high priest and the priest, because they're the ones that had the authority. They're the only ones that really had the authority to change the court of the Gentiles into a marketplace. And so it's the leaders, the people in power there that have done this. And the poor and the disinherited are the ones that are suffering from it. You could also say the Romans and the Roman leaders, because they actually looked out over the temple area. And so they were also complicit in this, but especially the leadership there at the temple. An archaeologist, Leon Rittenmeyer, says this: ancient historian Josephus calls Annas the high priest a great hoarder up of money. The sons of Annas had bazaars known in the Talmud, and they set up in the court of the Gentiles for the purpose of money changing and the purchase of sacrificial animals. It was the combination of their greed, the fact that they brought in foreign coins, and they carried out these activities in a sacred area that aroused the zeal of Jesus. So he says it's Annas the high priest and the family of Annas. Also, another archaeologist uncovered the burnt layer. When the Romans burnt the city, there was a whole layer of ash. They started digging in there around the temple area. And they found this whole part of the city of Jerusalem, which was a very expensive place to live. And they found that those were the priest's houses. They lived in the most extravagant part of the city. And there was one particular house, and I've actually been in a house. It's called the Burnt House. It was owned by the high priest of the house of Cothros. Now, this house of Cothros, and I'm getting into the weeds again, sorry. This is the family that's noted. They're actually noted in the Talmud, that's Jewish writings, that, and they're condemned for their lack of justice, for being unjust or unjust. And it's, the Talmud reads this, it says this: woe is me because of the house of Carthos. Woe is me because of their pens, for they are the high priest, and their sons are treasurers, and their sons in law are trustees, and their servants beat the people with staves. So these are the religious leaders around the time of Jesus that are getting rich off of this. In the house of Carthus, when you go in there, this burnt house, there's actually underneath the house, there was a place where this family, this high priestly family, was making coins, the same coins that would be sold at the temple, making local coins and then going and selling them and exchanging them in the temple and lining their pockets with this. Jesus makes a stand here. And notice what he's doing is he's standing against systemic evil, against systemic injustice, yes, against systemic racism with the treatment of the Gentiles in their own court. And so people that would say, well, it's just not there and Jesus didn't take a stand against systems. No, he did. In this case, he did. And it's very important when you, and you see it in all the Gospels, it's so important. And we can't miss that. And why did he do this? That's what you have to say also. Jesus did this because he had a heart for people, because he had a heart for the disinherited. And he empathized with those who are marginalized, disinherited, and oppressed. And so he takes a stand here. Now, why talk about all this? I'm going to conclude now, because I'm heading to the conclusion. I'm not quite done, but I'm heading to the conclusion. Our goal for this week is to learn empathy and compassion. And empathy and compassion can fuel us against racial injustice. It can also fuel us against systemic racism. But we have to be willing to see systemic racism first. And if we deny it's there, then we're never going to be able to see it. And one of the ways to see that it's there is to listen to people. to listen to the stories of people who have had to undergo it. I've talked to some people that survived the Holocaust. I know the Holocaust happened. To me, it's not, you know, some people say, no, it's not historical. I've talked to survivors. I've seen the tattoo on their hand, the numbers that were tattooed on their hands. And so by listening to their story, I understand the evil that they faced. And we need to do that. We need to listen to each other. And that's my basic assignment for this week, to learn compassion and empathy. Listen to people who are different from you. Listen to people and hear their stories. And I want to encourage you to not only listen to people, but read books, read biographies, read the stories of other people. Over the summer, I read a biography written by a friend of mine called I Was Under a Heavy Burden. It's about Hattie Tuggle. And Hattie Tuggle was a single, most of her life she was single, a Black woman who grew up in the Jim Crow era of the South. And she was a member of the Church of Christ. I consider her my sister in Christ. And reading her story allowed me to see what it was like to live in the Jim Crow era as a Black woman in the South, a sister of mine in the church, and it helped me to empathize with her. It helped me to understand what she went through, and I grew from that. And I feel like I was enlightened. I feel like I'm a better person from knowing Hattie. I mean, I feel like I know her a bit because I read her story. And I encourage you to do that. You know, next month is Black History Month in all of North America, US and Canada. And I encourage you to find a biography to read during Black History Month and dig in, dive into it and learn from people. I think that's important for us. I also encourage us to have safe conversations with people. And by safe conversations, I mean, find someone that you feel like you can talk to and there's not going to be judgment. There's not going to be aggression. There's just, you feel safe with that person and just ask them, please tell me your story. I want to hear what you've been through in your life. I think it's important that we have conversations like that because we learn and we grow from those conversations. Man, I got so much more I could say. But let me just give you one more assignment. And that is, as you know, Monday is Martin Luther King Day. And I want to encourage you on Martin Luther King Day. You know, it's a day of service, so find a way that you can serve. It's going to be hard this year because of the pandemic, but find some way. And maybe that's by calling people and having conversations with people. Maybe that's the way that you can serve this year. But I want to also to encourage you to listen or read one of the speeches of Dr. King. Just find one. I mean, as most famous as I Have a Dream there at the Washington Mall. Also is the Mountaintop speech, that last speech that he gave before he was murdered, assassinated. Fantastic. But I encourage you to listen to one of his speeches. You can find them online. They're easy to find. There's an audio book actually that was edited by Cornel West, and it has celebrities reading numerous speeches of Dr. King and sermons of Dr. King. And I encourage you to read a sermon or read a speech, or if you want to find a fantastic little book of his sermons, it's called Strength to Love. It's an amazing little book. And you can just download that book and start reading some of the sermons of Dr. King. But I hope that this will be a week in which we'll grow in our compassion and we'll grow in our empathy. And the way to do that is by listening. Listening intently, listening and believing, and listening and caring. And if we do things in that way, then when we look around us, we'll be more prepared to see systemic racism when it rears its ugly head. So, Ryan, that's what I have for tonight. I don't know if we have time to break into small groups or not, but you can decide.